You're listening to the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at cvillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at cvillepodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up today. I'm Dan Gould. Regular listeners of our podcasts might know Rick Britton. He's an historian and cartographer and a frequent guest on WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Rick also designs and hosts Virginia history programs for the Charlottesville Senior Center. In the fall of 2010, the Senior Center offered one of Rick's programs entitled Virginia History 101. Running from October 7th through November 18th, this six-part lecture series was designed for those interested in Virginia's fascinating early history. The lecture for October 28th, 2010, The Yorktown Campaign, was presented by Ed Lengel. Ed is a UVA professor of history, editor-in-chief of the Papers of George Washington, and author of a number of books and articles on Washington's military expertise. Following a fascinating description of Washington's obsession with attacking General Sir Henry Clinton's large British garrison at New York City, based on a premise that one great battle would end the war, Lengel then focuses on how the cooperation of the French Army and Navy and the intervention of Lady Luck put an end to the English Empire's hold on the American colonies. At the end, at Yorktown, close to 9,000 British veterans surrendered to a Franco-American force of almost twice that size. This is the fourth in a six-part series for 2010. Here's Ed Lengel.
That's right. Have to bring the microphone down a little bit. Rick is a little bit up here. And Rick played much more than just a small part in my books. He drew several excellent maps. And to Rick's credit, too, he's a guy who lives more often in the Civil War period and in the 18th century. I actually got him to draw some 20th century World War I battle maps for me. And he did a fantastic job. Rick is a great cartographer, a great historian. And I come to you as editor-in-chief of the Papers of George Washington. I've been there for 14 years now. And I became editor-in-chief a couple of months ago by virtue of outlasting everybody else at the project. And it is a fascinating project. We're working with about 140,000 documents. Now, they're all copies. We don't have any originals. Some people come up to me and they say, what do you do with all those original documents? That must be really exciting. And you must have security guards and all kinds of stuff around there. But no, we don't need to have any guards. Everybody who wants to know can figure out the combination to our document room because they're just all copies. But there are a lot of documents. These are documents that have been gathered up, copies of documents from all over the world. A lot of people think, well, you can go to one place like the Library of Congress and all of George Washington's stuff is there. There's a lot of stuff at the Library of Congress and the National Archives, but we've found stuff from as far afield as Tokyo and St. Petersburg and Warsaw and London and Paris. And these things are indeed still turning up in attics. I had about last year, I got a phone call from the personal assistant to a Texas oil man who had been cleaning out his boss's shelves. And no, it was not Ross Perot. People keep asking me that. He was cleaning out his boss's drawers in his desk, and he found shoved at the back of a drawer this four-page letter from George Washington, all in George Washington's own handwriting from 1773. And it was a letter that we knew he had written, but nobody had ever seen a copy of it before. And we hadn't been able to publish it because we hadn't seen a copy of it before. And so we were pretty excited, and they sent us a digital copy of it. And the guy just said, oh, my boss probably bought it some time ago and then forgot about it. So we are finding things like that. And people are finding things that are passed down to them. By ancestors, family heirlooms. They're finding them in old boxes and chests and attics. You know, this is something that makes Antiques Roadshow look pretty minor. Well, we're learning a lot about George Washington, and I'm a military historian, so I'm particularly interested in the Revolutionary War. And we have published now 20 volumes of Washington's Revolutionary War letters alone. These are letters to Washington and from Washington. And out of the total project length, it'll be 90 volumes when we're done. We've done 62 volumes so far. When the whole thing is done, about 41 or 42 of those 90 volumes will be on the Revolutionary War alone. So that gives you some idea. In those 8 years in Washington's life took up just about half of his entire correspondence, so it's immense. So people think, and I had a tendency to think too, well, you know, what more is there to learn about Washington? What more is there to learn about the Revolutionary War? We've heard so much about the Battle of Trenton and the Battle of Princeton, and we've heard so much about his other famous battles and about Yorktown. Well, there's not really much to say that hasn't already been said. Actually, there is. And actually, we're finding in 1779, the year of the war when everybody thinks nothing happened, all kinds of exciting stuff is going on. After 1778 was the year of the Battle of Monmouth. After the British evacuated Philadelphia and moved up to New York, and Washington fought them at Monmouth Courthouse in New Jersey, nothing happens until Yorktown, so far as George Washington is concerned. All the fighting is going on down in the South. It's going on in Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, until it finally moves up to Yorktown in 1781. If you're talking about Washington, there's really not much going on. What we're finding is two big things are going on. One is espionage. And people tend to think espionage, well, you know, big deal. The Revolutionary War, it may be kind of fun to talk about secret codes and secret writing, but it's not really very important. Actually, it was very important. George Washington in 1779 is developing for the first time in American history an organized espionage network, a network of spies, agents and counteragents, double agents, triple agents, people who were civilians, soldiers, men and women, Indians, but especially men who were masquerading as civilians who were working in and around New York City, British-occupied New York City. Washington had developed a very elaborate network and a very elaborate means of communication by which these spies could get into New York, gather information on British troop movements and British intentions, and then get that information back out to Washington by a very long and roundabout route. They were using things like invisible ink. Again, this sounds like kids' stuff, right? Big deal. It's actually fascinating. During most of the war, the first few years of the war, invisible ink was lime juice or milk. So, for example, if you're an American spy and you're operating behind British lines and you're pretending just to be a civilian, and you say, okay, I'm writing a letter to my Uncle Joe who lives behind the American lines, and I just write, "Dear Uncle Joe, I'm doing fine. Things are going well here in New York. We have plenty to eat. The weather's nice," and so on and so forth. You send it, you hope the British guards don't look at it too closely, and they send it on. Meanwhile, you write between the lines in lime juice or milk your secret message. You know, the British have moved 5,000 troops onto Long Island or whatever. When your counterpart on the other side of the lines receives this message, they would toast it. They would light a candle, and they'd run the letter just above the flames, over the flames, and if it was in lime juice or milk, the letters would come out of your invisible writing. Well, the problem was the British were not stupid, and they caught on to this pretty quickly. And so they run, whenever they get a letter going through, they'd run it over the flames. If something came out, your spy would be caught and hanged. Well, a man named Sir James Jay, who was the brother of John Jay, the American President of Congress and later creator of the Jay Treaty and Chief Justice, developed a secret recipe for invisible ink so that a spy could write using this invisible ink, and if you ran it over a candle, nobody could see what was there. Your counterpart on the other side of the lines would have a secret recipe. It would be a counterpart. He would take it and he would apply it to the letter, and only with that counterpart could you actually see what was written there. This recipe was so secret that we don't know what it was today. We still don't know what it was. Well, we've seen the letters after the writing has been brought out, but we don't know what it was. So that's one thing that's going on, and it kind of leads me to the next thing that's going on. Why was Washington so interested in espionage? Why was he so interested in spying in New York City? Because he was practically obsessed with the idea of attacking New York City. There's a myth about Washington. One of many myths about Washington is that he was a Fabian warrior. Now, some of you may know what that means. There was a Roman general, Fabius, from classical history, who was renowned for the idea of preserving his army to fight another day, for avoiding big battles, avoiding set-piece conflicts, preserving your army, keeping it away from the enemy in hopes that you can outlast them. And a lot of people say that was what Washington did in the Revolutionary War, that he was a Fabian warrior. The main thing he did is he preserved his army. He wouldn't let it get in the way of danger. He wouldn't let the British have a chance to destroy it because he thought he could outlast the British Empire. Nothing could be more wrong. Washington was certain for most of the war that we had no chance of outlasting the British Empire. And if you think about it, it makes sense. The British Empire is the most powerful nation on earth. It's also the richest nation on earth. We needed them a lot more than they needed us economically. And Washington saw that a protracted war created a danger of complete economic collapse in the United States. We think we've got it bad now. The American currency during the Revolutionary War completely collapsed. It became worthless. By about 1780, by 1780, 1781, you want to go out and buy a horse, you got to pay about $150,000 because the currency was so bad. Washington saw this, he saw the economic collapse, he saw how the economic collapse was leading to demoralization, people were losing their farms, they were losing their businesses, and he was convinced that people were going to lose their will to fight. So what did he have to do? He had to win the war quickly. He was searching year after year after year for the one battle that would put it to the British, it would whip the British, some kind of major military victory that might result in the capture of thousands of British soldiers, or even another Bunker Hill, killing a lot of British soldiers, that would convince the British that this war is too bloody, this war costs too much, it's not worth it. That's how Washington thought this war was going to end. Now, he thought that would happen at New York. By 1779, Washington was convinced that the opportunity for that one battle that would end the war was just about there. That's another thing we're finding in his correspondence. In the autumn of 1779, Washington heard a rumor that a French fleet under Comte d'Estaing, under Admiral d'Estaing, was going to arrive off the North American coast. And he hoped it was going to arrive off New York City. What does Washington do? He doesn't think, well, let's see what happens. What might we do? How are we going to plan this? Immediately, Washington writes. He calls in all of his troops everywhere. He writes to the state governors, call out the militia. Call out every man you have. bring in all the detachments of Continental forces, bring them to New York. We're ready to go. We're ready to attack. As soon as the first French ship appeared off New York, Washington was ready for a massive all-out assault on New York City, and he hoped that his spies would give him the information that he needed to succeed. Well, truth was, if he had done it, it probably would have ended in disaster. The British were very well entrenched in New York. They were determined to stay, and they were ready for just the sort of thing that Washington was planning. So fortunately for us, fortunately for Washington, Admiral D'Estaing was an incompetent. And he didn't appear off the North American coast. He preferred to go chase British ships down in the West Indies without any success at all. So he continued to go floating around until later on he was relieved. Well, let's move this ahead a little while. In July of 1780, a French fleet under Admiral Charles de Touche appeared in Newport, Rhode Island. On board the ships were 5,000 French infantry and 1,000 Marines under a man called the Count de Rochambeau. The citizens of Newport, Rhode Island, who had only recently been freed from British occupation, were delighted. They illuminated the city with lights in every window, and a delegation of officers came out to welcome the French ashore. The American general there, William Heath, wrote to Washington. He said, "For myself, I am charmed with the officers," speaking of the French officers, "and the Allies treated each other with regard and respect. It seemed like French and Americans loved each other." In fact, the story had been very different a couple of years before. In 1778, our friend D'Estaing had appeared with a French fleet off Newport, which was at that time under British occupation. And the plan was for D'Estaing to land some troops ashore and to cooperate with American troops under Major General John Sullivan of New Hampshire to attack the British in Rhode Island and conquer the city. Well, it didn't work out too well. The Americans came ashore, but the French, as soon as they heard rumors of a British fleet about to appear and some bad weather coming up, hastily got back on their ships and sailed away, leaving the Americans holding the bag. Well, we think things weren't going too well between us and our French friends a few years ago during the Iraq War. Things were pretty bad in 1778, and this is literally only a few months after France had entered the war. Things got so bad, and American feeling against the French got so bad that Lafayette, everybody loves Lafayette, right? Lafayette was afraid that he was in more danger in American lines than he was anywhere near the British. Some mobs threatened to hang him and stone him to death as soon as he appeared anywhere nearby. In fact, he wrote, "I am more upon a warlike footing in the American lines than when I come near the British lines at Newport." And the French, for their part, began to rethink their commitment to America. With friends like these, why should we bother? Well, Washington was horrified. And this is to Washington's credit. He wrote to Sullivan, remember the American general who commanded there at Rhode Island, "The disagreement between the army under your command and the French fleet has given me very singular uneasiness. The continent at large is concerned in our cordiality, and it should be kept up by all possible means that are consistent with our honor and policy." And Washington knew that our only chance of winning this war lay with the French alliance. This alliance was broken. We were, to put it mildly, in big trouble. And Washington was willing to go to practically any means to prevent any kind of breakup. He engaged in a cover-up, is what happened after Rhode Island. This was a cover-up. Washington halted information flowing out of Rhode Island to other parts of the continent that indicated that the French had abandoned the Americans. He knew what had happened. but he tried to cover it up. He sent out his own information indicating that, it really wasn't the French sailors or the French soldiers' fault. It just happened. It was an accident. Nobody's to blame. He knew very well that the French were to blame, but he covered it up. So as soon as Rochambeau arrived, Washington was determined to maintain friendly relations, and Rochambeau was as well. As soon as Rochambeau arrived in July 1780, he wrote to Washington assuring him of his veneration for his person and what he called Washington's distinguished talents. We find out later on Rochambeau probably didn't feel quite that fondly about Washington's skills. He kind of looked down on Washington a little bit, but he never let anybody see it. Washington's reply to Rochambeau was equally friendly. "I hasten," he wrote, "I hasten to impart to you the happiness I feel at the welcome news of your arrival, and as well in the name of the American Army as in my own name, to present you with an assurance of our warmest sentiments for allies who have generously come to our aid." Washington also sent his friend Lafayette, who had escaped the mobs a couple of years before, to Newport as kind of a personal ambassador to the French. And he opened a regular correspondence with Rochambeau about military strategy. It was one of Washington's great talents. One of the things he realized is make friends before you need them. Make friends, make acquaintances before you need them. This is what he did at the beginning of the war. It's what he did with the French. Is that as soon as he took command of the Continental Army in 1775, he wrote letters to every governor, to every significant member of Congress, to the president of Congress, to local officials, to farmers, to everybody who might be in some position to affect his army. Nobody was too low for him. He wasn't like people in some positions of power today. You know, if you write to them, you're lucky if their secretary reads it. You know, and it'll just get passed on through one channel and another, and it'll probably never reach them. I mean, who thinks if you write the President of the United States, you really think he's going to read your letter? I don't know. Washington would. And Washington would more often than not respond, especially if he thought that person would matter. And when his army hit tough periods like Valley Forge, those friendships counted. He was able to call them in, call in his friends. Well, like Governor Trumbull of Connecticut, "We've been corresponding for many years. You understand how passionately I feel about the cause. Our army needs food. Our army needs clothing. It needs supplies. We need your help." Trumbull has become friends with Washington. He trusts Washington. The aid arrives. He does the same thing when the French arrive, when Rochambeau arrives. He doesn't even know if Rochambeau is going to be able to do anything. He doesn't know if the French are going to be able to accomplish anything. He writes to them. He befriends them. He gains their trust. Well, for all the fawning correspondence that goes back and forth, Washington and Rochambeau could still be frank with each other. From the moment Rochambeau arrived, Washington began writing about the possibility of attacking New York. Rochambeau honestly replied that an attack like that couldn't have any chance of success without complete naval superiority and a careful and expert reconnaissance of British positions. Rochambeau hearkened back to an attack earlier that had been made by the French against Savannah, Georgia in 79 under, again, our friend D'Estaing. And Rochambeau wrote delicately, "I think that our general, who on so many occasions has given proofs of his capacity in offensive and defensive war, will approve those reflections," meaning reflections that we shouldn't attack New York, "and that he does not wish us to make here a second grave of Savannah." The attack on Savannah in 79 had been a disaster. Washington accepted Rochambeau's viewpoint, but he said, "I really still want to attack New York." Well, for several months, this conversation went back and forth, but it really remained moot. Washington hoped that another French admiral named de Touche would come out of Newport, Rhode Island. There was a crisis that winter. and sail south and help Washington in some of his other campaigns. And De Touche was about to do so. Again, it was another instance like D'Estaing. He heard that there were British ships somewhere in the area, and he immediately backed down. And Washington's anger got the better of him for a moment, and he wrote to a friend of his, to his cousin, Lund Washington, his farm manager, in confidence, privately, about complaining about the French and how they had given up on at Newport and they hadn't done what he asked them to do. Well, bad luck strikes. The British got the letter. Washington thought he could complain about the French in private. Nobody would know. Well, the French got the letter. I mean, not the French, the British got the letter. And they published it. Didn't go too well. It caused a sensation with the public, and they immediately started talking about Rhode Island all over again. Those cursed French. They're cowards. They're giving up on us. Washington immediately engages in damage control. He writes to Rochambeau, "I'm sorry, I really didn't mean that, just my temper got the better of me," and writes all kinds of wonderful things about the French. Rochambeau, to his credit, he doesn't take offense. Or if he does take offense, he doesn't let on. The alliance is too important. Shortly after this episode, the whole strategic situation changed. In May of 1781, Washington learned that another admiral, the Comte de Barras, was on his way to replace De Touche, who he couldn't stand, at Newport. At the same time, Washington discovered that another powerful French fleet, under Admiral de Grasse, had left Europe, bound for the West Indies. Washington was beginning to see if he could step back. This is one of Washington's great skills. He had a great ability to concentrate. He had a great eye for details. He was like Napoleon in that way. If there was one area that he was Napoleon's equal, it was in Washington's capacity to remember details, fine details. You could go up to Washington and say, how many wagons departed Philadelphia 2 weeks ago to bring supplies to our army? Washington would immediately say, 46. What were they carrying? He would immediately say, how many bundles of uniforms, how many rifles, how many, you could see this with him all the time. How many British troops do your spies report as being on Long Island? 9,503. He could do that. He could call it up in an instant. But another great facet of Washington's mind is that although he was detail-oriented, he could step back and he could begin to see when grand things were happening. He had a great mind for naval strategy, for world strategy, for what was happening in Europe, what was happening in the West Indies, how does it affect us? A lot of other generals at the time, they'd think, oh, you know, French fleets, they're always sailing around. What are they doing? Who cares? They never do any good anyway. Washington begins to see de Grasse coming from Europe, bound for the West Indies. Barras, a new French admiral, a very competent man, coming to take command of the French fleet at Newport, where Rochambeau's troops are holed up. What is this going to mean? Washington's mind is already thinking. Well, Washington learns that after finishing his business in the Caribbean, de Grasse's fleet would have time to operate for a few months off the coast of North America. The British general, again, you can see things converging. The British general, commanding general in New York, Sir Henry Clinton, meanwhile, has significantly reduced his garrison in New York City to reinforce British forces operating under Cornwallis in Virginia and North Carolina. Washington begins to think, there's something possible here. New York, they're weakening New York. French fleets are in the Atlantic. What might we do? Well, as it happens, Rochambeau suggests a personal conference between himself and Washington at Wethersfield, Connecticut, to discuss strategy for the 1781 campaign, and Washington eagerly agreed. The Wethersfield Conference was the first meeting between Washington and Rochambeau. I'm sorry, it was not the first meeting. There had been another brief conference before, back in September, but it was the first important meeting between Washington and Rochambeau. And they spent their time at Wethersfield beginning to confer about the possibility of attacking New York City. But the important thing that was happening there was the personal relationship between Washington and Rochambeau. Rochambeau, for his part, even though he kind of maybe looked down on Washington a little bit, didn't show it. He had been ordered to regard Washington as his superior officer, and he treated him respectfully, but without false or obsequious regard. He wasn't flattering or fawning. That never worked with Washington. Washington, who always had kind of a sneaking admiration for professional military men, was deferential to Rochambeau's superior training and experience. And while he insisted on attacking New York, he still consulted with Rochambeau on the tactical aspects of how to carry it about. So both men developed a professional respect for each other. The conference closed with an agreement that the French admiral, de Grasse, coming from Europe, would be directed to sail to New York after he completed his operation in the West Indies, and that Washington and Rochambeau would unite their armies as soon as possible to begin operating against the city. There's no question that Rochambeau's regard for Washington and Washington's regard for Rochambeau became very deep and very personal over time. And it was strengthened by experiences that they had together in the months that followed. For example, in July 1781, 2.5 weeks after the French and American armies linked up, Rochambeau and Washington went with a party of engineers to reconnoiter a small peninsula opposite Long Island, where the British troops were. The purpose for this expedition of Washington and Rochambeau was to scout the British defenses in preparation for attacking New York City. Well, the engineers with them surveyed the enemy defenses while Washington and Rochambeau, quote, slept worn out by fatigue at the foot of a hedge under fire from the cannon of the enemy's ships who wished to hinder their work. Well, they slept for a while right next to each other, and after a while, Rochambeau woke up. And he looked about in surprise, and he jostled Washington with his elbow. They had forgotten about the tide. This really happened. They had forgotten about the tide. They had gone out to this peninsula via a causeway. Well, they weren't underwater. They weren't floating. But as they looked back to where they came, they were cut off. They were in a little island now in the middle of the water, middle of the river, and they could easily, very easily, if a British boat had been nearby, they could have been caught. It was just the two of them. But fortunately, some American dragoons were on shore. They kind of waved to Washington and Rochambeau stranded there on their little island. And they galloped off, and a while later they came back with some civilians with a couple of rowboats who came out and went out to the island and got Washington and Rochambeau and brought them ashore. Well, so Washington and Rochambeau, you know, they develop things like this bond you if they ever happen. Now, you and a friend get caught on a little island together, that'll bond you. So they develop that relationship, but meanwhile, relations on a more personal level between the Americans and the French could be difficult after the French and American armies linked up. The Americans found the French to be stiff and gaudy and unreliable, to be kind of dandified and more interested in how they looked than anything else. And the French, meanwhile, looked down on the Americans as ignorant amateurs who smelt bad and didn't use perfume to tidy themselves up and powder and wore ragged uniforms and didn't clean their weapons well, and so on and so forth. One French officer sneered, and I quote, "In beholding this American army, I was struck not by its smart appearance, but by its destitution. The men were without uniforms and covered with rags. Most of them were barefoot. They were of all sizes, down to children who could not have been more than 14. Well, Washington and Rochambeau immediately tried to suppress these tensions by ordering civility and scrupulous respect among the other soldiers. Well, the preparations for attacking New York continued till August 14th, when Washington opened a packet from Barras to find a letter that de Grasse, remember the French general who was going to the West Indies then coming up to North America, de Grasse had written from Haiti just 2.5 weeks before. Well, de Grasse had 29 warships and 3,200 troops, and he was on his way. Washington, you can see him, beginning to get excited. But he wasn't going to New York. He was going to Virginia, a little place called Yorktown. Warning that he could not remain on the coast of North America any longer than mid-October, de Grasse wrote to Washington that he was anxious that Washington and Rochambeau should, quote, have everything in the most perfect readiness to commence our operations on the moment of my arrival. That left only 2 months for the Franco-American army to march from New York to Yorktown. All of these troops were concentrated around New York City. Just over 2 months for them to get down to Yorktown, where a large British force under our friend General Cornwallis had holed up. This is a distance of over 400 miles. Washington would have to make an immediate choice, either to cooperate with de Grasse or to stay where he was, awaiting another opportunity to bring the British to battle at New York. Washington was a stubborn man. Sometimes he would fixate on an idea, and he would stay with it no matter what. He was dogged. He was determined. And he had been thinking for years about attacking New York City. But now, here's one moment. The clouds have parted for one moment, and one moment only, showing one fleeting chance, one fleeting opportunity to achieve this great victory that he had been searching for so long. The only difference was it's not at New York, it's down in Virginia. Well, you would think that also this letter might provoke some kind of discord between Washington and Rochambeau. Apparently, as it seemed that Rochambeau, as it turned out to be true, had quietly encouraged de Grasse to sail to Virginia, in contradiction to what he had agreed to at Wethersfield. Washington could have protested this. He could have complained. He could have said, "We agreed de Grasse would go to New York." Instead, Washington accepted this turn of events philosophically, and he looked immediately to the advantages it presented. Instead of recriminating with Rochambeau, they agreed to move south. They would invest the British positions at Yorktown by land, while the French fleet cut them off by sea. The astonishing movement of the Franco-American army to Virginia, from New York to Virginia, is a great military epic. It began on August 19, 1781. 4,000 French soldiers and 3,000 Continentals marched south in three columns. They entered Princeton, New Jersey on the 30th, They paraded through Philadelphia from the 2nd through the 4th of September. On September 5th, Washington learned that de Grasse's fleet had arrived off the Virginia Capes. Washington left Head of Elk, Maryland on the 7th, September 7th, riding with Rochambeau and his aides through Baltimore and the farms and towns of southern Maryland. Everywhere citizens turned out to welcome them. Washington, Rochambeau, and their staffs then moved on to Mount Vernon, which Washington had not seen since he left to take command of the army in the summer of 1775. And they stayed there for 4 days. Somehow, Washington found suitable lodgings for all his guests and regaled them with the best Virginia food and entertainment he could muster. Events at sea, meanwhile, were bringing the war quickly toward its conclusion. In New York, the British general Henry Clinton had watched Washington's march for Virginia with equanimity. He didn't think anything was going to come of it. He knew de Grasse's fleet was on the way, but he had underestimated its size. By late August, a British fleet of 19 ships assembled at New York under the command of Admiral Thomas Graves. Clinton assumed that that fleet of 19 ships alone could handle the threat to Yorktown. And Cornwallis, who felt the same way, made no attempt to drive for the interior to get out of Yorktown before escape by land became impossible. So they knew the Americans and the French were coming. But both men were disastrously wrong. Sailing from New York on August 31st, the British Admiral Graves arrived at the mouth of the Chesapeake on September 5th, and he promptly stumbled upon de Grasse and his 29 warships, outnumbered by 10. The battle that followed left Graves' ships severely mauled. It was a great French victory, one of the few cases, in fact, where the French are able to beat up on the British at sea. Didn't happen too often. Practically miraculous, if you think about it. And as the British ships drifted south, stunned, toward Cape Hatteras, Barras, French admiral, slipped into the Chesapeake undetected. On the 14th of September, seeing that its weakened force was incapable of facing the reinforced French fleet, Graves sailed back to New York. Washington stepped on stage just as the British fleet departed. He entered Williamsburg on the afternoon of September 14th. With Rochambeau still by his side, he rode straight through an encampment of Virginia militia without ceremony. But he dismounted and paid his elaborate respects at a camp of French infantry who had arrived with de Grasse. That evening, Washington enjoyed dinner with his French allies, and while the generals shared what Washington called the hilarity that good claret always brought about, the French military band regaled them with music in Washington's honor. There was good cause for celebration. Washington and Rochambeau had a powerful force of 7,800 French soldiers, 3,100 militia, and by now 8,000 Continental troops. Trapped before them lay a hitherto inconceivable prize, Cornwallis with an army of near 9,000 men. The story of the capture and siege of Yorktown is pretty well known, but even more remarkable is the degree to which the French and Americans cooperated. There's much truth in what Washington later wrote to the President of Congress, and Washington wrote, "I cannot but acknowledge the infinite obligations I'm under to His Excellency the Count de Rochambeau." The Marquis Saint-Simon, commanding the troops from the West Indies, the other general officers, and indeed the officers of every denomination in the French army for the assistance which they afford me. The experience of many of those gentlemen in the business before us is of the utmost advantage in the present operation, and I am sensible that it must give Your Excellency and Congress the highest pleasure to know the greatest harmony prevails between the two armies. They seem actuated by one spirit, that of supporting the honor of the Allied arms and pushing their approaches with the utmost vigor. De Grasse, the French admiral, wasn't always easy to deal with, and his assistance on departing the coast quickly after only 2 months kind of limited what Washington was going to do. Washington nevertheless treated the French admiral respectfully, even when de Grasse was even taller than Washington. Washington was 6'2", de Grasse was a few inches shorter. De Grasse jokingly referred to Washington as "my dear little general," and Washington tolerated that. As they had before New York, Washington and Rochambeau worked together on every aspect of the planning for the siege, and Washington took advantage of the French general's advantageous knowledge of siege warfare to plan the approaches to the British positions and the actual assaults on redoubts 9 and 10 by French and American troops on October 14th. As executed, these attacks were minor masterpieces of tactical cooperation, not least because each nation attacked their respective redoubts in their own manner, using different tactics but with equal success. The capture of those redoubts completed the entrapment of Cornwallis's army, and it allowed Washington to bring his artillery to bring Yorktown under fire from three directions. But there was also a lesson to be learned, one the commander-in-chief, wasted no time in passing on to his troops. The general reflects with the highest degree of pleasure on the confidence which the troops of the two nations must hereafter have in each other, he announced in general orders. Assured of mutual support, he's convinced that there's no danger which they will not cheerfully encounter, no difficulty which they will not bravely overcome. On the morning of October 17th, an American soldier, saw a drummer mount the enemy's parapet and beat a parley. And immediately an officer holding a white handkerchief made his appearance outside their works. The drummer accompanied him beating. Our batteries ceased. The British officer was led blindfolded behind the American lines, and they took from him a letter from Cornwallis requesting a ceasefire of 24 hours to discuss terms of surrender. The letter was then presented to George Washington. An ardent desire to spare the further effusion of blood, Washington replied to Cornwallis, will readily incline me to listen to such terms for the surrender of your post as are admissible. The articles of capitulation of surrender were signed 2 days later on October 19, 1781. Importantly, they were not between Washington and Cornwallis alone, but they were between Washington, Rochambeau, and De Grasse on the one part, and Cornwallis on the other. The French and Americans also appeared as equals during the surrender ceremony that followed. At 2 p.m., the Allied army entered the British positions and then lined up with the French on the left and the Americans on the right. The captives, the British captives, then marched between them, their drums in front beating a slow march. At the head of the British rode Brigadier General Charles O'Hara, because Cornwallis had wimped out, pretending he was feeling sick. O'Hara approached Washington and Rochambeau, who sat mounted on their horses side by side. He then turned to the French commander, Rochambeau, and began speaking. Rochambeau interrupted him and gravely pointed to Washington. Apologizing, O'Hara turned and proffered his surrender to the American commander-in-chief. 8,000 British and German soldiers and seamen were now prisoners, along with 214 artillery pieces, thousands of muskets, 24 transport ships, horses, wagons, 2,000 pounds in good hard money, which the Americans desperately needed, and over 20 battle flags. The American and French officers and men, meanwhile, quote, could scarcely talk for laughing, and they could scarcely walk for jumping and dancing and singing as they went about. That's a contemporary account. Determined to retain his self-control, even at the moment of his greatest military victory, Washington was more restrained. But he could not altogether avoid the general hilarity. On October 21st, he boarded de Grasse's flagship, and he had cause to repent an earlier careless proposal that he had made to embrace de Grasse to celebrate the British surrender. Spying mon cher petit général, or my dear little general, on board his flagship, de Grasse immediately rushed over, seized Washington, and kissed him. First on one cheek, then on the other, and thirdly on the lips. According to an eyewitness, Washington received the salutation like a coy damsel. He was never easy with French mannerisms. The war, so far as the fighting was concerned, was over. Washington's general orders to his army reminded the Americans that victory would have been unattainable without the aid of France. Rochambeau remained an American until December of 1782, when he and his aide, Chastelot, took their leave for France. Washington's farewell letters to these men demonstrate the different relationships that he had with both of them. Washington and Chasteloup had been very good friends, and apparently they had shared a lot of wine together. And this phrase that of the general hilarity that good claret and good wine can bring was from a letter that Washington wrote to Chasteloup, because the two of them maybe had got a little bit tipsy or even more together. So Washington wrote to him on his departure, "I can truly say that never in my life did I part with a man to whom my soul clave more sincerely than it did to you. I regret exceedingly that circumstances should withdraw you from this country before the final accomplishment of that independence and peace which the arms of our good ally has assisted in placing before us in so agreeable a point of view. Nothing would give me more pleasure than to accompany you in a tour through the continent of North America at the close of the war in search of the natural curiosities with which it abounds, and to view the foundation of a rising empire." As for Washington, that's a lot. Washington's farewell to Rochambeau was a little bit more conventional, but it was nevertheless fond. He says, "I cannot, my dear general, permit you to depart from this country without repeating to you the high sense I entertain of the services you have rendered America, by the constant attention you've paid to the interests of it, by the exact order and discipline of the corps under your command, and your readiness at all times to give facility to every measure which the force of the combined armies was competent to. To this testimony of your public character, I should be wanting to the feelings of my heart was I not to add expressions of the happiness I have enjoyed in your private friendship, the remembrance of which will be one of the most pleasing circumstances of my life. My best wishes will accompany you to France, where I have no doubt of your meeting the smiles and rewards of a generous prince," meaning the king, Louis XVI, "and the warmest embraces of affectionate friends." What had allowed Washington and Rochambeau to work together so effectively? First was their mutual respect. Washington, hitherto more than a little suspicious of the French in general and of French officers in particular, earlier in the war he was like many Americans, he viewed them as dandies who were pompous and boastful and didn't know what they were doing. Washington was able to shed his French and Indian War era prejudices, which many of his fellow Americans shared, and to see Rochambeau for what he was, a profoundly intelligent and capable soldier with a wealth of experience and knowledge that would be of profound benefit to the American cause. Rochambeau, for his part, refused to buy into the contempt that many European professional soldiers felt for the amateur Americans, and he treated Washington with consideration and respect that was unfeigned. More than anything, Washington and Rochambeau's effectiveness as a team resulted from their sober understanding that each ally had entered the war for its own purposes and with its own objectives. Their realism fostered a businesslike attitude among their officers and their troops. While the French and American soldiers before Yorktown did not exactly love each other, they did at least conceive that they were fighting in the same cause. John Sullivan and D'Estaing at Rhode Island, had by contrast seen the war only in terms of their own ideals and desires. This attitude at the time quickly spread to their officers and made age-old suspicions worse and prevented effective cooperation. In the end, Rochambeau and Washington, by contrast, showed that realism worked better than idealism, in this case at least. The same lesson had to be learned over again in World Wars I and II, and it continues to resonate in the 21st century. Thank you.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.